Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Driven to Business. Keep in mind, we are streaming live on biz1190.com. We are podcast on eddiemayfield.com, and we are glad you're here. We're going to be talking about taxes during this program, tax policies, and how they affect you. There is no one in business, in fact, there's no American, that is not affected in some way by taxes. Most of us in business probably view it as more of a necessary evil and an annoyance than perhaps those that do not run businesses. But nonetheless, no one escapes the hand of the tax man. Our guest today is an expert in tax policy. Daniel Witt is the president of the International Tax and Investment Center in Washington, D.C. He is a world-renowned expert in tax policy. Daniel, thank you for appearing on Driven to Business.
Well, Eddie, it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for that flattering interview. It may be a bit of embellishment there, but you know, I have worked on taxation issues in over 85 countries around the world for the past 22 years.
Well, Daniel, I am in sales. Keep that in mind.
Well, you're in sales, so you understand. Like President Reagan said in 1986, when he was launching our last major tax reform here in the United States, taxes matter, and they do indeed matter. They affect investments. They affect human behavior. I mean, we think about it as we go about our daily life, and we may not know it, but we're making a lot of economic decisions that are driven by taxes as individuals, whether we be individual consumers or business people. I mean, you think about the sales tax holidays, and do you buy that TV set in New Jersey or New York? Or if you're filling up your tank of gasoline as you're driving through New England, where you have different states with different excise taxes, I mean, those things matter.
Absolutely. It does affect behavior. It affects not only behavior, Dan. I think it affects attitudes. I just returned from Russia. I spent some time in St. Petersburg and Moscow over there. And one of the things that I was honestly a bit surprised was how entrepreneurial the place sort of feels now. And I know you've spent time in that part of the world. Talk to us about that.
Eddie, I've spent a lot of time there. That's where ITIC got started, in Russia and Kazakhstan, right in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union. My first visit was there in 1991. When I showed up, it was the Soviet Union. When I left, it was the CIS.
Wow.
And we saw the fall of the Soviet Union and the start of the Russian Federation. I mean, over the 22 years I've been going there, well over 100 times, I've probably seen four different countries. And you do have an entrepreneurial class. You do have a very vibrant, booming middle class. And it's seeing the Russian people and knowing the Russian people and the depth of their soul and their entrepreneurial-like behavior is what gives me a lot of future about Russia. You have a model of statist capitalism that's troubling, but from considering where they started in 1991 as a new country after over 70 years of control and domination by the communists in a totalitarian system with all of the economy controlled. I mean, now you have more of the economy in private hands than in many European countries. It's been a remarkable transformation and one that it's really hard to understand for us sitting here in the United States.
Talking to folks, or just in conversations with people my age and perhaps a bit younger than me, but they would talk about the Soviet times, and in every case, they would talk about it in sort of a dark fashion. I heard several stories of people that lived there. They would go to grocery stores, and there's nothing in the grocery store.
Yes. I mean, in 91, 92, 93, some of my favorite memories of this business were hosting Russians coming to America for the first time. And we'd always have them to our home because I have great memories of going to people's homes. But then after dinner, we'd go to the Safeway, and they would be overwhelmed. You know, how many choices of cereal? How many, the ladies with the cosmetics in, you know, Safeway, you don't think of as an upmarket cosmetic shop, but they were overwhelmed. Or even, I remember walking in, we were out at Stanford University with a group from Kazakhstan, and we went to a student pizza place, and it was one of these exotic places with imported beer, with over 80 kinds of beer. And the guy said, well, I'll have beer. And the waitress said, what kind? And he said, I'll have beer. And he was just overwhelmed by the choice. Now, that's different. I mean, when I first went there, when these people are speaking about the Soviet days, I mean, you had, you know, unremarkable, you know, terrible cars, waiting lists of 8 to 10 years to buy cars, similar waiting lists to get a refrigerator, phone lines, you know, with a state monopoly, you may get it installed in 3 years. And what a market economy, the mobile phones, automobiles, foreign travel, how that has, cable TV stations, I mean, it's opened up. The Western world has come to those places in the world.
You know, Daniel, we at our company, EMA, we have had the privilege of employing several folks from Russia, and some of this was back in the 90s, and I had that same experience of one gentleman in particular who came here, and I asked him after a few weeks what he thought of the United States, and he brought up a grocery store.
Yep.
And he just said, my wife and I are just blown away when we go into a grocery store.
And I bet you the work ethic of those colleagues is far superior than any 22, 23-year-old American.
They were very, very smart, very good in pure science.
The level of maturity of the young people. And, I mean, it's not by accident that we've got, even though our work now is far beyond the former Soviet republics, you know, some of our hardest working staff are that we've had from many, many years are with us from that part of the world.
Daniel, several of us sort of made the observation while we were there, and I don't know, this is I've not spent the time there that you spent there, so this is more of a cursory observation than you would have. But we said that the Russians seem to be walking away from what we're walking toward. Do you have a thought about that?
Well, let's actually maybe try to talk about Russia in the context of what's happening in the United States today, what's happened in the United States since the global economic crisis of 2008. You know, Russia's had remarkably stable macroeconomic performance. You remember, they had the economic collapse
right
in 1991 after the Soviet Union when they had the rapid liberalization.
Right.
Then they had the excessive debt in the mid to late 90s, and then they had the collapse of that debt in the currency crisis in 1998. They've recovered. They paid back all of their loans. They don't have a foreign deficit. They built up enormous cash reserves that they used during this last crisis since 2008. And, you know, and they were criticized by the global financial community, but that's exactly what a cash reserve is for. A foreign currency reserve is for a rainy day, and, if you know, that was about as bleak and rainy as I hope we'll ever see it in our lifetime.
Right.
They were able to get through that. So in many ways, their macroeconomic performance is better than that of the United States. Their policies. I mean, I wish I was a Russian taxpayer. 13% flat tax as an individual, 20% corporate tax. Compare that against the United States, 36%, and, you know, pushing, you know, between 40% and 50% when you take the state and local taxes as an individual.
Right.
And but what you've got, and that we have, and I hope as long as I know in America, is we've got the upside. You know, we've got, even with the problems that we're facing today in Washington, you know, the full faith and credit of the United States government, I mean, bank accounts disappeared as recently as 1998 in Russia. So we like to kick around the banks. But at the end of the day, I think we as Americans trust our banks. They don't in Russia. So you still have we're not so sure what tomorrow is going to bring. So the psychology, they look like us. As you walked around St. Petersburg and Moscow, you know, you can really relate to Russians. There's a lot that we have in common. But psychologically, after 70 years of communism in the czarist period, so hundreds of years of really abuse by the government on the people, you've got a lot of hesitancy and short-term thinking.
You know, not to dwell on Russia overly, but I was struck with another thing there, Dan, that I don't think I had ever thought of before. When we're going through these czarist museums, and this was prior, of course, to the Soviet takeover, and this almost obscene, in my opinion, display of wealth. And keeping in mind that these people took this wealth at a time when the country was, your average subject there in Russia was just dirt poor. And we're going through these museums of these jewel-encrusted saddles.
Well, I'm sure you're talking about the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg.
Exactly, yes.
And as you walk around that museum, I'm sure the thought crosses your mind, well, now I understand why the people overthrew
exactly.
The
That's exactly what we thought. No wonder these people revolted.
When you're walking through the museums, whether it be Versailles or the Louvre in Paris or in France.
Right.
And again, I think that our Constitution, our system has prevented that. Our system, it has worked. And I think the fundamental difference that I see, now I'm worried about it with the slow erosion here in the United States, is what stimulates innovation, what stimulates risk-taking. Those are the catalysts that fuel economic growth, economic activity, which create jobs. And that's, you've got to be able to be confident that if you succeed, you can keep your upside. And that's where confiscatory policies, you know, there's still a hesitancy by entrepreneurs in Russia. You know, you don't have to think back too long ago to Mikhail Hortakovsky.
You got to figure when they were taking it. Daniel, let's stop for a break right quick. This is a very interesting discussion. I'm so glad you're here. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Stick around. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Our guest today is Daniel Witt. Daniel is the president of the International Tax and Investment Center and a very interesting guest. And we were talking about the change that's taken place in Russia, where they're sort of on a journey toward where we have been. Daniel, I read where you said, I know guys like you hate having things you read, that you wrote, read back to you, but this is interesting to me. You said that the Western model of liberal capitalism that has been the greatest contributor to economic growth in the history of mankind has lost much of its luster following the 2008 global financial crisis. Nevertheless, it is still being embraced in many other countries. Daniel, are you concerned at all that we're putting this liberal capitalism candle sort of under a basket while perhaps in other parts of the world are raising it high? Or do we just not know what we have?
I am concerned. For your listeners, let's just clarify. When we say liberal, that means free markets,
right.
Free people.
Free markets.
Liberal as the Europeans use it.
Right.
In America, it would be conservatism, but it's limited government.
Right.
This is the engine that's driving the growth in sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, places like Nigeria are the fastest growing economies on Earth. We're seeing this in places like Indonesia with 7% growth, in China, you know, albeit slightly different models, but models of liberal capitalism. And it's taken its hit in Western Europe. It's taken its hit in the United States following the global crisis. And
Danny, as a result of that, I mean, honestly, it's sort of a bit of an example of that. You've also noted that there is anger, I think that's your term, against multinational corporations by governments in some cases, and fueled not by thoughtful people, but by in many cases journalists and other organizations. So I guess the question is, why are they doing that? Why do these multinational corporations seem to become the whipping boys for economic policy?
Well, it seems like now, a couple years after the crisis, we're no longer having the fear that we're standing on the edge of a cliff, not knowing if we're going to fall off like we were in 2009, even questions in 2010. And I get the sense, and I would put organized labor in there too,
right,
that it's payback time.
Right.
It's payback time, and also they're fighting over a shrinking pie of corporate income tax. The corporate income tax is shrinking. So what you're seeing are you know, these witch trials, like we saw with the CEO of Apple Computer,
right,
before our United States Congress, before the United States Senate Finance Committee. You saw it with Starbucks and Google and Amazon before this Public Accounts Committee in the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, and trying to make them poster children. And in reality, you know, you look at where they've put factories, where they've put distribution centers.
We employ tons of people.
They've employed people who pay taxes, who buy things, who pay sales tax, value-added tax, pension fund contributions, often state pensions. And so they're looking at one piece of the puzzle and scoring enormous political points with like-minded journalists who like to write a story that is not fully fact-based. They pick one fact where you need to look at what is the contribution that these multinational companies are making. And if you've got a product that was designed in California, but then taken further to how do you commercialize it by software engineers who sit in India, and then the product is manufactured, so you've got the intellectual property, maybe from Ireland. The product was produced, the genesis was in California, commercialized in India, manufactured in Indonesia or Malaysia, and then distributed through 15 facilities around the world. How do you share? How do you share that? And that's what's happening right now is governments, many of whom, like the United States, like France, like the UK, who are desperate to balance their budgets, are on these attacks on the multinationals, rather than thinking about how do we grow it a bigger pot? How can we make our economy more hospitable? I mean, really, Russia, you know, going, and we want to move on, but in the early 90s, where the Russian companies, the Russian oligarchs didn't trust their government, you saw a mass exodus of capital to places like Cyprus. When you look at the economic statistics, and it shows you that Cyprus is the largest foreign investor in Russia, what that tells you is Russian money is coming home.
Right.
And I haven't looked at the statistics here in the United States lately, but you know, how much money is coming home? And I'd be willing to say not a lot, and it's being parked around the world in perfect accordance with the U.S. tax rules because it's not so hospitable to bring it back here.
You know, Dan, even now, you know, you think on a global scale, and you know, I run a small business, so I think a little bit different. But you know, what I do writ large is what you're talking exactly about in global, because you know, guys like me, we look around, and when we see uncertainty and when we perhaps are fearing what's coming on us, the healthcare would be is a great recent example of this. Just when we're trying to make a decision as to whether to hire someone, and I know this is overblown a lot in the press, but it really, in fact, does happen. When my leadership team and I sit around and we think about hiring people, we absolutely take into account what's going to happen. And when I get a big giant tax bill in, and I, you know, it stifles what else we're going to do. And so there's a real world and a real people affect this stuff.
I mean, to pay a tax bill.
Right.
And, you know, when you think about you with your radio production business, think about a dentist. Why would he, you know, when he's, if he has to pay an effective tax rate, 50-60%, why would you work more than 4 days when you could play golf on Thursday right. afternoon and Friday with your fellow dentist friends? Think about what Ronald Reagan said when effective tax rates, okay, then they were 70 to 90%. Why on earth would he make more than two or three movies a year? Why would you work hard and make that fourth movie, that fifth movie, when you keep 20 to 30 cents on the dollar? You know, why do you want to work so somebody else makes the money? You know, again, it gets back to what motivates human beings to work hard. And that's what's made America great.
Well, you know, we had the I guess the disappointing part of this, we have about a minute here, is that worldwide, we have examples of this. We know what happens to production when you collectivize a farm. We know what happens to those farms. We have history. We have recent history of this.
You can hide and not be accountable.
Exactly.
And think the other guy's going to work while I'll stay back and get my peanuts.
Exactly.
You know, we want you to work hard and get your pot of gold at the end of the day if your idea is a good one and succeeds in a marketplace, not that you're going to work hard, take a risk, and then have somebody take your money.
Exactly. You know, Daniel, I grew up in a world where successful business people in the community, we admired those folks. Now, there may have been some jealousy of them, but generally speaking, we were wanting them to be successful. In fact, we aspired to be like them.
And I think, by and large, that's still the case today in the world for the United States company. The problem, in large part, is here at home after 2008 when we saw the economic capital shift from New York to Washington. That's when things started to get messed up.
That's a great statement. You know, I look around, occasionally get these, our company, we're involved in the HVAC business a little bit. You look around at where that's really being sold and growing, and you look at that Washington, D.C. is one of the leaders in that, and always makes you think, what's the industry in Washington, D.C.? Well, of course, the industry in Washington, D.C. is the government. They don't have another industry there, really. And as that grows, it's taking resources from other parts of the country. You are listening to Driven to Business. I am your host, Eddie Mayfield, streaming live on biz1190.com. We'll be back. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm glad you're with us. My name is Eddie Mayfield. We are podcast on eddiemayfield.com. You can also go there to contact the program if you like. Our guest today is Daniel Witt. Daniel is the president of the International Tax and Investment Center. Daniel, we've been talking in just about tax policies in general and sort of the policy side of that and the real world effect. But let me talk to you about that. Let me raise a different subject with you. John Adams rather famously said that our Constitution was made only for a moral and a religious people, and it is wholly inadequate for a government of any other. As a young man, I used to do a fair amount of business in some third world countries. And I was always shocked that everyone there seemed to be on the take. And if you didn't dare ship a product down there unless you got payment in advance, because you would never get paid if you didn't do that. And so I saw firsthand where, and these economies were generally terrible. And I used to think about on the plane rides back and forth about that you can't, how hard it is to do business in a place where there's no underlying values, where that, you know, it's considered fine to lie, steal, and cheat. And despite all of that, where that's accused of that in the United States, my experience has been in this country that doing a lot of business people, most business people are actually quite moral in their dealings, and their word is a bond, and they will do what they say. But do you see any?
Well, I think America is unique in that it may be one of the few places in Earth. Of course, you've got the rest of the Anglo-Saxon world,
right?
Canada, New Zealand, Australia. where strangers can do business because of the rule of law.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
In so many other countries, it's relationships. It's a code of honor protecting the family name. I mean, you see this in Russia. You see this in many of the Asian countries. You see this in African countries, you know, protecting your father's name. So that also is a guiding force. So, I mean, I wouldn't – at the same time, you've got a much higher degree of corruption. Corruption is much like, you know, the higher taxes are perhaps the biggest drag on – that, along with uncertainty, are the biggest drags on economic growth in the United States. You look at taxes, which are corruption, which is effectively an informal tax that you're seeing in so many countries. But also, you know, what a very troubling trend that relates to the earlier question about many of these NGOs or civil societies or journalists or even religious leaders today are suggesting that U.S. business or businessmen or women are immoral.
Right.
And that's very, very troubling because they have a duty to their company, to their shareholders, to pay the right amount of tax, to follow the law.
Right.
And that's where the judgment needs to stop. And it's not a question of morality. It's a question of are they paying the legal and right amount. Now, you need to have greater transparency. Transparency will make it easier for governments, authorities, people, journalists, if they're fact-based and intellectually honest, to answer the questions themselves. Are they paying the right amount? So transparency, there have been initiatives, quite a few of them, particularly in the extractive industries area, oil, gas, mining, to put the spotlight on how much money is going in to these African countries producing diamonds or gold or oil, or uranium, and to hold the governments accountable to their people. But what we've seen is this transparency initiative has been hijacked and has become a morality issue or a fairness doctrine. And, you know, it's like you and I can have a debate for the next 5 hours on what's the fair amount I should be paying my 13-year-old twins for allowance.
Right.
Well, there's no answer. And so that's been troubling, and then also the corruption. But again, no two countries are alike, and in you know it's been encouraging to see you know the concept of rule of law building. You've even seen remarkable progress in 22 short years of independence for Russia, and it you know is a contract the same there as here? No, but you're starting to have a greater confidence in those instruments, and that's true in many of these countries around the world.
I don't know if you ever thought before, and you know, you may not deal much with in your field, you may not deal with things like eBay much and things like that. But you know, eBay is no longer just something that people use to sell their old mattresses or beds or something. In business, there's a lot of business
transactions.
Yeah, a lot of it, and you know it's interesting because we've been doing this a long time with eBay. eBay is sort of self regulating. This is not an advertisement for eBay. There are other people you can certainly do business with online, but you know there's a thing on there where the buyers rate a seller, and the sellers rate the buyers. In other words, and if you mistreat a buyer. Like you don't deliver what you said you were going to treat. Well, he's going to go on eBay and say, "Hey, this thing was not what was advertised," and that is the death of that buyer.
Well, these indices are very, very powerful, and in fact, the World Bank has an index that they do every year called the ease of doing business, and the United States ranks number 4. There's a ranking of 185 countries.
Wow.
Singapore number 1, Hong Kong 2. New Zealand 3, U.S. 4, Russia's number 112. So, and I know from working with countries, their presidents, they look at these. I mean, Kazakhstan, one of the goals articulated by President Nazarbayev several years ago to guide their reforms his instructions to his government was, by 2015, we want to be in the top 50 of the ranking.
Wow.
And that guides. So having these, it's kind of like a child coming home with his report card for his parents. These things matter. And how do the others see you? And also, it comes down to, you know, capital markets. And you know, a company wants to invest, whether it be Coca-Cola, right there in your hometown, into an $80, $90 million bottling facility that will employ people, and you think about the multiplier effects. You know, that the facility may employ 200 or 300, but then the distributors and the salespeople, and right down the road, I mean, you'll have, you know, thousands of people that will see jobs tied to that. Well, they don't need to put one in every country necessarily, or they,
right.
You know, and so the countries need to compete. And I can tell you, in the boardrooms or where they're making these decisions, things like taxes, things like regulations, things like stability and predictability of the business climate, the investment climate, those are factors that determine, does this big investment go in country A, B, or C?
You know, even here in Georgia, we interviewed the governor here a few weeks ago on Driven to Business here. You know, Georgia has done pretty well in recent years in attracting business down here, and a lot of it has to do with the tax. But it's not only tax structure. There are other things. But tax structure is a big part of it. But in general, I think it's just, is there a business-friendly environment? Do the political people like business?
And now our friends that see the world differently than you and I, Eddie, would think, oh, the governor's giving it away.
Right.
Well, number one, it's not his to begin with. He has to be hospitable and welcoming to get the investments there.
Right.
He has to win the competition for capital. With capital come new jobs. With the capital come additional taxes, which can provide enhanced services to the people of the state. So again, you've got to look at the full picture. And I know, I'm sure you'll see a headline story. You know, Company X comes and governor gives away X billion dollars in property tax or something like that.
You do hear things like that, but I, as we said, my worldview is a little different.
The full picture and what's that doing for the state of Georgia.
Exactly.
And that's basically our business. ITIC, we're a nonprofit research and education foundation founded in 93, and the whole idea was to help Russia and Kazakhstan understand they're competing for capital and help them develop their tax regimes to win this competition for capital. And I started doing this as executive director of the U.S. Tax Foundation, the oldest tax and budget organization in the United States. And we basically, there was enough demand from the government side, and we're financed by approximately 100 multinationals from the United States, Europe, and Asia. There was demand on the private sector side to create an international non-governmental organization, which became the International Tax and Investment Center, ITIC. And most importantly, we wanted to make it international so no one thought we were trying to export the U.S. tax system.
Daniel, I sometimes wonder, and you are in a better position to know this than me, but I have a suspicion when I'm looking at tax policies being written out of Washington in particular, that a lot of the congressmen and the staffers whom are writing those policies could know really nothing at all about running a small business. Could not, and I have often thought, I bet half of them can't explain what a sub-S corporation even is. Am I wrong in those suspicions?
Yeah, well, forget about the complex structuring. You know, what's it take to meet a payroll?
Exactly.
You know, what's it take to develop a product and bring it to market that people want to buy, not go ask the government to subsidize it, like, you know, an electric car or something.
I have often said any politician that had to make a payroll a few times would be a different politician.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think of tax policy as a country's most important trade policy. But it the way Washington and our Congress and the executive branch is compartmentalized, you know, we seem to lose that connection.
I mean, Daniel, we have 1 minute. How, and this is not enough time to do this, so you'll come back after the break, but how do we and I know this is your job, how do we talk these governments into pro-investment tax policies? How do you do that?
You need to continue to show the benefit of pro-growth policies and how they can mean good things for the people of the country or the state. Awesome. And you need to keep bringing it back, and that's where, why is it important to America to have our companies competing successfully around the world? It's not a zero-sum game.
No, and it isn't.
To connect those policies to the prosperity of the people. That's exactly. Our challenge.
Well, Daniel, you're a fascinating guest. Please stick around for the last segment. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm your host, Eddie Mayfield. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Driven to Business. Fascinating guest today, Dan Witt. Dan is the president of the International Tax and Investment Center. Daniel, a lot of talk around the country here about things like the fair tax, flat tax. You'd mentioned that Russia you'd talked about their tax system. But an informed person like you, what sort of a tax, individual tax reform do you support?
Simple. Make it as simple as possible. What we have now is far too complicated.
Amen. So,
a broad base, a low rate, one that's as neutral, transparent, and for gosh sakes, that's predictable.
You know, I think so many people, when you're talking about just, and again, this is a small business guy talking here, I don't think even our employees or people that don't own or operate businesses have any idea how much money we spend, not just on taxes.
The compliance.
But to comply with them. It's unbelievable.
I mean, that's what an economist would call the dead weight loss.
Right.
We're paying people to move papers around, create computer software, collect data. And you think about, a company with $100 billion turnover, or a GE.
Right.
The financial data that you've got to connect all over the world for the U.S. tax return. And I think what annoys the individual taxpayer, the citizen, is, paying money and really having a feeling you're paying money for nothing. I think that's the fuel that is that's energizing the disgust with the Obamacare the additional costs are quite clear, but the benefits are not. Just like I said that it's incumbent on business to be continuing to communicate what is the value proposition, what are the benefits that we are providing, to you, a government of Russia, and for your people, or, take a company like Chevron, the largest American company, the largest foreign investor in Kazakhstan. They're constantly communicating what this means for prosperity to the people. Conversely, that's still a question that has not yet answered or may never be answered on some of the policies we're seeing coming out of Washington today.
Daniel, on the simple tax, does that mean you would support a flat tax
I've been on record of supporting a flat tax. What rate? It's unclear, but I'd be willing to give up some of my deductions, exemptions.
So would I.
To have a flat rate with a commitment that it's going to be that way for 5 to 10 years, because my fear with a value-added tax is it's the best way to raise revenue for a government.
Yeah.
And if they significantly cut the income tax, put in place a VAT, what's going to happen in 5 years? They'll start to raise the income tax again. So,
right.
There's that, you've got to have that compact of trust. And, you look at today's, over the weekend, there was a CEO summit in Washington, and the conclusion, the overriding conclusion, what CEOs want, and this could be the Fortune 100 guy, or it could be the guy running the Main Street shop in Buckhead, is policy clarity,
right,
and certainty. I'm certain there are billions of dollars on the sideline to be invested in capital and expenditures, to be invested in human capital, hiring new people. But when you don't know what the rules of the game are going to be in 6 to 12 months, you keep your money out of the game.
That's exactly right. And you are correct. Whether that's a small business like us making decisions about increasing inventory or pushing a new market.
You don't want to get stuck with two more people on your payroll
right.
if you think that the government policy is going to change in 6 months.
Exactly.
You're going to work your existing folks harder and perhaps, you know, be more generous with compensation. But at the end of the day, those are two jobs that aren't going to be created.
Right. Dan, if I could get you to pull your tax expert and policy hat off for a moment, you've had a very successful and I would argue a very important career. How did you get into this career, and did anyone help you get there?
Well, there's been a lot of help along the way. I've been very fortunate in that regard, but we see some opportunities, things that you. That were really fun opportunities that were unconventional. You know, I studied at Western Michigan University, did an MBA, and was interviewing with Fortune 100 companies. That's what you did when you had an MBA.
Right.
And, you know, GE, GM, those kind of places. Instead, I took a Rotary Foundation fellowship and went to New Zealand. You know, I knew I could pick up where I left off. Well, that whet my appetite, writing a book on trade policy at the New Zealand Institute of Economic Research in 1985. I had no interest then in coming to be a financial management trainee, so I came to Washington and got hooked up in the policy business during the Reagan administration and became the head of the Tax Foundation, and it was there where we were partners in a conference. It was a U.S.-Soviet trade conference that had me first step foot into the Soviet Union, and the relationships we made with the head of the tax administration, the deputy minister of finance, that took root. And I made subsequent visits over the next couple of years, and then we founded ITIC in 1993. And, you know, very fortunate with some people I had a lot of respect with over the years. Bill Frenzel, who represented Minnesota in the Congress, was a leading Republican on the Ways and Means Committee, was one of our founding chairs, along with John Robson, who used to be the dean of the Emory Business School. He was the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. And Lord Peter Walker, who was really one of the revolutionary fund managers and investment bankers, and was Mrs. Thatcher's Minister of Energy and Minister of Agriculture. Those were all our founding chairs. And in the credibility that they lent to a new nonprofit, and the friendship and the trust, and just, you know, keeping me from doing stupid things where you could go and be intellectually naked, exposing your ideas and having them say, well, sometimes yes, but the most valuable was when I don't think you want to do that.
I already know the answer to this. You have a lot of passion when you're talking. Any of our listeners could tell that immediately. So I'm assuming, I think I told you I was going to ask you this, but is it fun being the president
of ITIC?
Oh, Eddie,
most days I don't feel like I'm working. And you know, we're a nonprofit foundation, but you know, we run it like a business because you know, we want to be around tomorrow.
Right.
So we've got financial systems, and I've got colleagues that help me with that. But never do I forget that our purpose in life is to promote free markets and free people. And that is indeed making a difference. And in its small way, we're promoting prosperity. And you know, as I raise a glass and toast, whether I be in Russia or in Hong Kong or in Tanzania, you know, I in my heart I know that our real work is making the next generation better off than us.
Well, that's not only a fantastic, I think, career goal for you and a goal, but also something that we need so bad. I love the idea of free markets and free people, and I don't know that you can separate those things.
You're exactly right.
And Dan, you've been a wonderful guest. Thank you so much for being on Driven to Business today. and taking the time out of your very busy schedule. You've been a fascinating guest, I think very informative, and I've learned a great deal talking to you, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you, Eddie.
Folks, you've been listening to Driven to Business, heard every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. here on Biz 1190 WAFS-AM. I am Eddie Mayfield. We'll see you again next week. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.